Welcome to Rex Factor!
This week, Eleanor of Provence.
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince consorts of England, from Elswith to Prince Philip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apologies for our prolonged absence, but we are now back, and every Monday from now on is fully dedicated to Rex Factor, meaning we're going to be much more consistent with our release schedule.
Get on board the content bus, because G-Man is coming to town. How's that, Mr. Professional Podcaster?
I know, yeah, a full day's employment.
It's blooming great, isn't it? Oh, I'm so chuffed.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram, where we are at Rex Factor Pod, like the Rex Factor Podcast Facebook page, and email us at rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com. And we're a free podcast, but if you'd like to hear more of us, then you can donate monthly, join the Privy Council to access bonus content, and we have now moved this to Patreon. So sign up by going to www.patreon.com/RexFactor, where we'll be doing lots more fun stuff with all the new things on offer. So if you've been thinking about signing up before, now's the time to do it.
Be there at... You'll be like, see the first post on Facebook type thing.
Except that obviously I had to upload all of our previous episodes, so we were already 260-odd posts in. But still.
Biography!
So, Eleanor of Provence was born in about 1223, the second of four daughters of Count Raymond Berengaire IV and Beatrice of Savoy, all of whom, that is the mother and the daughters, were noted for their exceptional collective beauty, with Eleanor herself described as the fairest May of life by Piers Langtoft.
This is another beautiful Eleanor, then. We have a run of them.
It is a bit of a stock statement for high-born women to be described as beautiful, but it's remarked on by a number of chroniclers, just how beautiful all of the sisters are. Anyway, she was born in Aix-en-Provence, which is the capital of Provence, which at this time was an independent county rather than just being part of France. So it stretches along the Mediterranean seaboard from the Rhone Valley in the west to the foothills of the Alps in the east. And it was the first Roman province beyond the Alps, and it was called Provincia Romana, hence the name Provence.
Ah, Rex fact. Nice.
Like Navarre and Berengaria, Provence is something of a between place. So Eleanor would have spoken Occitan, so linking her to Aquitaine, but her father was the House of Barcelona, and thus linking her to Spain as well.
Oh, right, yeah, nice. Oh, powerful then.
Mm. Her father was also a noted patron of troubadours, and the Provençal court was famous for courtly literature, music, tournaments, and Eleanor herself inherited his love of reading, but her place politically in the world was more defined by her mother's Savoyard family, because her mother was the 10th of 14 children. So Eleanor has eight uncles, and they're nicknamed the Eagles of Savoy because they're all highly ambitious diplomats with connections all across Europe.
Yeah, Provençal. Is that then something that comes from Provence?
Yes.
Huh. Can't believe I never put those two together.
Part of their network of alliances was through Eleanor and her sister's marriages, and indeed all four sisters end up being married to kings. So her eldest sister Margaret marries Louis IX of France, Sancha marries the King of the Romans, and Beatrice the King of Sicily, and Eleanor, of course, will marry the King of England, Henry III.
King of the Romans is a catch, right?
It is, though it's sort of a bit of an unstable period, so they don't exactly have a Holy Roman Emperor at this time, so you kind of have disputed people, so it's King of the Romans, but not Holy Roman Emperor.
Good title.
Hmm.
Crap car.
Anyway, Henry III is the man for Eleanor. He was a boy king, just 9 years old, when he inherited a very unstable kingdom from his father, King John, whose power was being limited by the First Barons' War and the Magna Carta. As an adult, poor old Henry spends 10 fruitless years searching for a bride, suffering 5 rejections along the way.
5 rejections? Hang on. No, I mean, like, I remember the bit where he was looking for a new bride, but what were the rejections about?
Well, he's just, you know, it's all diplomacy rather than the women actually turning him down. But he did get as far as a proxy wedding, but it ended up being vetoed by the Queen Mother of the King of France.
What's a proxy wedding?
It's where the parties aren't actually there, but it's sort of done with stand-ins.
Is that a thing?
It was a thing at the time, yeah. It was sort of a way to cement the alliance quickly, even if you couldn't actually get the two people quickly to be with each other.
Oh my goodness. And to think for years emails weren't considered evidence in court. That is ridiculous.
Well, but in this case it didn't help Henry because it ended up getting annulled.
Yeah.
Now, Eleanor is actually from really a relatively minor family, and she doesn't have any lands or titles to offer, but one of her uncles, William of Savoy, was able to attract Henry's interest, because marrying into the Savoyard continental network and all those influences does help Henry in his grand ambition to recover the Angevin Empire, which had been lost by his father. So even though they don't have a lot of land, a lot of money, they have lots of connections that will help him build the alliance that he needs.
Okay.
And also, yeah, marrying Eleanor will help offset any benefit that Louis IX of France will get having married one of her sisters.
Yeah, lovely.
Hmm. Henry is also just clearly very keen to get married, which is evidenced by the fact that William managed to negotiate him down from an initial dowry demand of 20,000 silver marks to a compromise figure of 0 silver marks.
Goodness me. He should write The Art of the Deal.
Yeah.
Wow. How do you do that? Just turn around and say no.
Yeah. How about nothing at all, but she will actually marry you? It's like, yeah. To be honest. Yeah. Just really want to get
married
now.
That's amazing. What a burn.
Yeah.
And to the King of England as well.
Yeah. Anyway, Eleanor of Provence is going to be married to Henry III. So at just 12 years old, Eleanor is suddenly whisked off to become Queen of England.
Whoa, 12?
Just
you didn't mention that.
No, yeah, only 12 years old. So it's a country she's never been to, doesn't have any links to, and hasn't really had any chance to prepare herself for it. The first time she even sees Henry, who is 16 years her senior, is at their wedding on the 14th of January, 1236, in Canterbury Cathedral.
Oh, it's so cruel, isn't it? It's as close to a kidnapping as you can get.
Hmm.
Poor girl.
Yeah, it's not a nice situation for Eleanor. From there, it's straight to Westminster Abbey for an incredibly grand coronation, processing along streets lined with silks, banners and garlands. The procession is led by trumpeters, followed by Henry, who is said to be glittering very gloriously beneath a purple silk canopy. And Eleanor follows, similarly bejewelled in her own canopy, wearing a golden crown set with magnificent gems.
I mean, it does sound a bit Kardashians touring Vegas.
It's fair to say that this is all rather overawing for poor Eleanor. As I said, she's only 12 years old. She's pretty isolated, inexperienced, ignorant of the politics of her new country. So it's not very surprising then that she quickly attaches herself to her Savoyard uncles and kinsmen, and they become increasingly prominent at the English court. So her uncle Boniface becomes the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Uncle Peter becomes one of Henry's chief advisers. And likewise, they see Eleanor as their route to achieving dominance in England. So Peter acts as something of a mentor to Eleanor, and he urges her to cement her influence at court by centering her power around her role as Queen Mother to Prince Edward. And yes, that Edward.
Yes, this is Mummy, isn't it?
This is Mummy.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And indeed, her focus and her ambition as queen is sort of really never to do with England or financial gain. It's always the advancement of her immediate family and family networks that are perhaps influenced by that initial sort of isolation. She's always really building that strong family unit and then just pushing that as her core goal in everything she does.
Mm.
Okay. So, as evidence of that, she works hard to promote the Savoyards at court, as well with very lucrative marriages. She ensures that Edward's household is filled with Savoyards, which means that she is basically has got control of it. It's people that she trusts who are looking after her son. Because there is a bit of an early threat at court, because when the children are young, she is perhaps a little bit uncertain about Henry's brother, Richard, the Earl of Cornwall, who at various times does flirt with rebellion against his brother. So in the 1240s, she got Henry to decree that key castles and wardships, as well as Edward's actual person, would be granted to her and her uncles rather than Richard in the event of Henry's death.
Oh, no, this, I see, yes, that this is the Richard that then fed Edward all those stories of Crusade that got him all excited. It was his uncle Richard.
Mm. Richard had persuaded Henry to grant him the county of Gascony, which is basically the last vestige of the old Angevin Empire. But Eleanor gets Henry to revoke this because Gascony had always been intended for Edward. But she managed to take the sting out of this by arranging for Richard to marry her sister Sancha, which thus brings Richard a bit more into the family fold, but still means that Edward gets his due.
Oh, that's clever. How does she have a lot to do with that?
She does, yeah.
Oh, nice.
And it's Richard who does go on to be elected King of the Romans.
Oh, right.
So it's Eleanor doing stuff, but of course she couldn't have done this without Henry's support, and they do develop a very close and affectionate relationship. Henry is a very kind and generous man, and he'd gone to great lengths to make her feel comfortable when she first arrived in England. He was also keen to advance the Savoyards at court. Their closeness is indicated by the fact that on one occasion a madman entered Henry's bedroom at night and tried to assassinate him. And Henry was only saved from death by virtue of the fact that he wasn't actually in his bedroom, but rather he was in bed with Eleanor.
Oh, right. Goodness. Was it, how was the assassination, what was the proposed method?
Just climb into the bedroom with a knife and stabby stabby.
Oh, the old stabby stabby. Mm. Death by stabby stabby. They love it. I was hoping for sort of, you know, poison, all that sort of stuff, and, you know, exciting Edward the First type things.
No, it's very much route one.
Kill him.
Yep.
Okay.
So, as Eleanor gets older, she grows in confidence. She becomes much more strongly aware of her priorities and her prerogatives, and she doesn't blush at the idea of challenging people if she felt that they were in the wrong, including her husband Henry. So, he's a good man, but he's also quite a weak king, and he's a bit more open to manipulation than stronger rulers. So in 1246, when Poitou is captured by France, the Lusignans, who are the children of Isabella of Angoulême's second marriage, and thus Henry's half-siblings, they get invited to England by Henry.
Mm.
And they quickly establish themselves as a rival faction to the Savoyards.
Uh-huh.
So previously, oh, yeah, it was all just people Eleanor's family getting all the presents. Now Henry's half-brothers and sisters come along and they're getting the presents too.
Yeah, and they're going, oh, yeah, yeah, what's this?
Mm. Yeah. So when violent clashes erupt between the Lusignans and the Savoyards, Henry wanted to try to keep the peace, but Eleanor, always very much tunnel vision, intervenes for the Savoyards, and Henry is so furious at this that he ends up banishing her to Guildford for 2 weeks.
I'm sorry, people of Guildford. I mean, I've never been, I don't think, but as far as punishments go, it's pretty good.
Another example of her acting against Henry was her continued determination to protect Edward's inheritance in Gascony. So she sided with Henry's lieutenant, who was trying to put down a rebellion in Gascony, and Henry, feeling like he hadn't done a very good job, refused to pay him and tried to have him taken down in Parliament. But Eleanor, seeing that this is all going to cause further problems, persuades Henry to give him the money and also acts a little bit in the background to help exonerate the lieutenant in Parliament.
Why?
A sort of pragmatic approach that she sees there's a rebellion in Gascony. This is for Edward. We need to keep it secure. We can't have this massive dispute lingering where the guy in charge doesn't have enough money to do what he's meant to be doing. Just pay him the money and we'll sort it out.
Good. Yeah, I mean, that seems sensible, isn't it? What's Henry thinking? What's his problem? Why?
Well, he's just grumpy because all of this stuff, it's all kind of happening at the same time. It feels like Ellen has suddenly got a bit more confident. She's her own person now. She's going against him in various things. Because Eleanor isn't deliberately rebelling against Henry as such. She just does what she thinks is best for the immediate family interests. So if she happens to think that Henry's got it wrong, then...
Yeah, yeah, that's just asserting herself, like, nowhere near rebellion, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, the downside to Eleanor's family focus was that she was rather blindsided to the impact that this had on other people, or rather, she just had no interest in the impact that it had on other people. Mm. And the barons were increasingly frustrated with both Henry and Eleanor. The excessive favour being shown to the Savoyards and the Lusignans, costly expeditions in France, also a disastrous attempt by Eleanor and Henry to secure the throne of Sicily for their second son Edmund, which didn't prove successful and just led to huge taxes and a massive papal debt.
Weird. Mm. Why Sicily?
It's not quite as illogical as it seems, but equally, it did end up being a bit of a... what's the phrase?
Oh, yeah. Like a white elephant, golden flamingo or something like that.
It did end up being a bit of a golden flamingo.
It sounds to me like the Scots getting involved in Mexico in the 17th century. 18th century, whatever it was.
So in 1258, the barons have suffered enough, and they decide to take decisive action under the leadership of Henry's one-time lieutenant in Gascony, a certain Simon de Montfort. So in 1258, Simon de Montfort and six other nobles confront Henry, forcing him to agree to the provisions of Oxford, which require him to govern in tandem with a council of 15 barons and hold three parliaments per year.
Mm. I mean, seems reasonable, but presumably he hates it.
He doesn't like it, but he's forced to go along with it. Uncle Peter, for Eleanor, is one of these barons, and another one of their demands is that the Lusignans are expelled from England.
And who are they again? They're the people that aren't Savoyards.
Yeah, so those are his half-siblings, so the children of Isabella of Angoulême by her second marriage.
Yeah.
So the fact that she's had this dispute with them, her uncle's on this council, the Lusignans are being expelled, one wonders if Eleanor is perhaps at least approving of what's going on, if not maybe a little bit involved behind the scenes. If she is involved in any of this, then it quickly spirals out of her control. Prince Edward is determined to be his own man, and he starts to assert his independence by allying himself with the Lusignans, and even, for a time, with Simon de Montfort.
Yeah, well, you know, he's just checking it out, seeing the lay of the land, then he'll make the right decision, as we all know.
Well, Eleanor has to work pretty hard to try and disentangle Edward from these various influences, and the country is gradually descending towards a civil war. Now, Henry had tried to reassert control against the nobles by gaining papal absolution from a bull to uphold the provisions of Oxford. And then he and Eleanor and Edward and Edmund all go off to France, and they ask Louis IX to arbitrate on the dispute. Mm-hmm. And Louis rules in Henry's favour, which many of the nobles back in England rather grumpily attribute to Eleanor's influence.
But of course he does. Right?
Well, he's been asked to look at it a few times, and he hadn't been quite so one-sided previously, but by 1264 he sees that this is just fully an attack on the concept of monarchy. I think maybe earlier he'd thought, yeah, it does seem like Henry's being a bit rubbish here.
Yeah, okay. So first of all, it was not an immediate rebuke because he's being a douche, but later, we can't have this.
Yeah.
But that is probably where, actually, a bit of Pope action might be useful.
And the Pope is also sort of largely on side. Again, this is where some of Eleanor's links, although not popular in England, they do mean that they have a lot of support in Europe.
Yeah. Okay. And the Pope, Pope's big in Europe.
He is. Very big in Europe. Anyway, Henry and Edward return to England in 1264, but tensions are now escalating into actual open warfare, and Henry suffers a disastrous defeat at the Battle of Lewes. He is captured and reduced to just being a figurehead for a Simon de Montfort government, while Edward is made into a prisoner.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So exciting, this, isn't it?
So this is really a disaster for the royal party, the king and his heir, and indeed Henry's brother Richard, all captured by Simon de Montfort. Now, Eleanor has remained in France, and she was described as being anguished and wearied with grief. But she is now the leader of the royal party. She is the most senior person at liberty, and she uses all of these connections that she's got through her Savoyard relations to raise lots and lots of money, and she funds a huge mercenary army with which she is hoping to come back to England and rescue her husband and son.
Boom. Wow. What, like some sort of Boudicca on D-Day invasion of Britain?
Yes, if you like.
Nice.
So she gathers this large force at Saint-Omer and prepares to invade England. But a combination of bad weather, papal opposition, and Henry's fears for Edward's safety means that it never ends up sailing for England.
Oh, that is disappointing. Oh, I would have loved that.
Yeah.
She must have been gutted, right? Yeah,
her money runs out, the soldiers disperse, and she's forced to regroup in Gascony.
Oh, dear. It's not a fate anyone wants, surely.
However,
she's at least it's not Guildford.
I mean, she's had worse. However, all is not lost, because in 1265, Prince Edward dramatically escapes from captivity, raises his own army, and takes Simon de Montfort on in battle. And at the Battle of Evesham, Edward wins a glorious victory, rescues his father, brutally mutilates Simon de Montfort, and it is a royal victory.
I mean, that it's got Act 1, then it all turns around Act 2, and a prince coming to the rescue at the end. Come on, people. Let's get a proper film done, please. And I am available on Wednesdays, Thursdays and Fridays and can bring my own sword.
Eleanor gets to come back to England now, of course. But despite the victory, things have changed. Henry's health diminishes after this point, whilst Edward is increasingly powerful and dominant at court. Meanwhile, Eleanor and her Savoyard family network are never to enjoy the same level of influence again that they'd had before the war.
Why is that? Just because it's now all about Edward? Oh, brilliant setup for the sequel, though. You know, Edward the Man, when it is the father in decline. And oh, it's perfect.
It's not
it?
His story, though, today. It's Eleanor of Provence's story, of course.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So in 1270, Edward leaves the country because he's going off on a crusade. And interestingly, presumably because he is conscious of his mother's unpopularity, she's given no role in the arrangements for his lands or indeed the guardianship of his children, despite her experience and leadership capabilities.
That's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, his brother Edmund puts his children in Eleanor's command. So it's presumably a political decision that Edward feels like if he wants the country to be stable, then he needs to not be seen to be giving his mother this prominence.
Okay. Like how long before this was Boudicca on the waves bit?
That's 6 years ago.
Oh, right. So she's still in her prime. Like,
yeah,
this
so because obviously, as you said, she's 16 years younger than Henry. So although his health is diminishing, she's just sort of early 50s at this point. So she's got plenty of energy. It's not that she couldn't cope with it. It's a political decision.
Well, ours is not to question Edward.
It's while Edward is away that Henry III dies in 1272. Eleanor had taken preparatory measures in the months before Henry died, so she'd secured control of various wardships, secured control of Windsor Castle, and had also ordered a survey of all of her lands just a few days before Henry died.
Why would you do that? Get your house value.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing is that although obviously they'd won the war, tensions are still there between the monarchy and the nobles. And she's actually a much more isolated figure now. All of her children are out of the country, with Edward and Edmund both off in the Crusades. Her Savoyard uncles are now dead. Her sister's dead. Henry's brother Richard is dead. So actually, if things do go south, she's not got as much support around her as she would have done 10, 20 years ago.
Oh, I'm surprised it's that dodgy.
Well, it's not that it necessarily is dodgy so much as that she's preparing for the eventuality, in case it is.
She's just, yeah. Sensible.
Thankfully, there is no great unrest on Henry's death, and when Edward does return in 1274, he is crowned king without facing any opposition.
Yeah.
Eleanor, though, once again, is given no political role as Queen Dowager, though she does pretty much raise two of Edward's children, Henry and Eleanor, appropriately enough, and devastated when young Henry dies in her care in 1274. So she founds a priory in Guildford in his memory.
I don't delightful 2 weeks there when I was a young girl. I think I'll go to Guildford.
She suffers further tragedy the following year, 1275, when both of her daughters die just 1 month apart.
Oh, gosh. How old are they?
They're both in her, both in their 30s.
Oh, man. The same thing? I mean, that's quite just a horrible coincidence.
Probably related to childbirth. Certainly one of them is. Anyway, Eleanor retires from court to the convent of Amesbury, which is a daughter house of Fontevraud.
Remind me?
So that's the where Henry II, Eleanor of Aquitaine, Richard the Lionheart, Isabel of Anglet.
Oh, yeah.
Are all buried. She styles herself Eleanor, humble nun of the Order of Fontevraud of the convent of Amesbury. Though in reality, she's not quite so humble because she breaks with convention by retaining all of her lands and wealth.
Good for her.
And also extensive renovation work is done at Amesbury before she arrives so that it meets all of her comforts and requirements.
Yeah, it's not a priory, is it? That's a priory in the sort of modern detox hotel sense of the word.
She does remain in touch with court, though. She writes various affectionate letters to Edward, asking for favours for her family friends, offering some unasked for advice, chides him for not writing back frequently enough.
Oh, dear. I wonder why.
She's joined by two of her granddaughters at Amesbury. Eleanor, who would go on to become the abbess of Fontevraud, and Mary, who, given stories of subsequent gambling and sexual liaisons, is probably not well suited to being a nun.
Oh, right.
And then finally, on the 24th of June 1291, Eleanor of Provence died at the age of 68 and was buried, according to convention, at Amesbury.
Nice. That's a good long period of time for her longevity score.
Unfortunately, her bones are now lost, so we can't do a pilgrimage for Eleanor of Provence. Amesbury passed into the hands of Edward Seymour, brother of Jane, after the dissolution in 1536 under Henry VIII. And Edward Seymour pulled down the decaying church, leading to the destruction of her tomb. So her bones are lost.
That Henry Tudor... I mean, Henry VIII. Not a fan.
Anyway, that was the life and consortship of Eleanor of Provence. We'll have a quick break, and then it'll be time to review her.
Battleliness!
She has a very strong sense of her prerogatives, as we mentioned in the episode, not afraid to take anyone on in pursuit of them, including her own husband. Henry was shocked to discover that Eleanor had appointed a candidate for a church in one of her own wardships, robbing him of the chance to appoint his own candidate. And when he heard that she'd already got someone in place, he decried, "How high does the arrogance of woman rise if it is not restrained?" So he dismissed her man and put his own guy in, but Eleanor wasn't standing for that, so she took Henry to court.
Her husband?
Her husband, the king.
But not actually, like, it would be sort of like taking the office of appointments to court rather than him, right?
Well, I mean, he's not in the dock, but nevertheless, it's his interests and her interests. He uses 21 lawyers, but loses the case.
Oh, that is... Is that a Rex first? I mean, is that a legal first?
Maybe. Bit of a public humiliation for Henry.
Yeah. He's meant to be appointed by God, isn't he, at this point?
Once again, Henry in a debating situation does not seem to be a strong candidate.
Yeah, true.
Now, her main battliness, though, is in the Second Baron's War. She was always instinctively more determined on strong action than Henry. It was a point where, in 1263, during a rebellion, Eleanor and Henry were holed up in the Tower of London. Henry wants to come to terms with the nobles pretty much straight away, but Eleanor completely at odds with him. And according to the St. Albans Chronicler, she strove against it with all her strength, and got so frustrated with him that she actually decided to abandon him in the Tower of London and try to get to Edward in Windsor, who was taking possession of various castles.
That's amazing. Because she's, in the medieval sense of it, being the bloke about the situation, wanting to fight and all this.
She didn't actually make it to Edward, however. She was chased off by a mob, and when Henry wouldn't let her back in, she had to stay with the Bishop of London until she was forgiven.
He wouldn't let her back in. Oh, he's petty as well.
So she does suffer a few sort of reversals. So she doesn't always win against Henry. So we mentioned with the Lusignans and the Savoyards when they were clashing and she supports the Savoyards and she got sent off to Guildford. She was only allowed back on the proviso that she distributed gifts to both sides and made a very public display of non-partisanship.
Right.
So she's not always walking all over him.
Mm. But, I mean, yeah, she eventually has to... Normality has to be shown to be resuming.
Yeah.
But in the crisis, she will sort of rebel to get it done and then whatever. Yeah, Henry, I'm sorry. Oh, she's brilliant. He's rubbish.
And of course, the big crisis is when Henry and Edward were captured at the Battle of Lewes and Eleanor became the de facto leader of the royalist cause. She'd been preparing for the war, or for a war, for years. She'd been distributing gifts to buy alliance in Flanders as early as 1259. She now made full use of her numerous contacts on the continent and embarked on a furious fundraising campaign, took out loans from Florentine bankers, sold off 3 bishoprics, and pawned some of the crown jewels to Louis the Ninth.
Yeah, I mean, that you got to do what you got to do. I honestly think, in that situation, the best thing that could have happened to that side was Henry being permanently out of the way with in prison and her being given the chance to actually do something.
So with all of this money, she raised a very substantial mercenary army, her son Omar, which consisted of soldiers from Flanders, Brittany, Savoy, Spain, Germany, as well as her own troops and some English ships that she requisitioned from Gascony.
Mm. Brilliant.
Brilliant, but the big negative, though, must be the fact that the invasion force never actually set sail.
Yeah, but she can't. She's, you know, weather.
There was weather. Also, the papal legate, who actually owned the land at St. Omer, didn't approve of the invasion. And also, Henry was concerned at what de Montfort might do to Edward, given that Edward was a hostage. It's probably unlikely that he would actually have gone to the step of murdering the heir to the throne, but still, a bit of concern there.
Well, I thought Henry was banged up with Edward.
Well, Henry is being used as a figurehead for the government.
But Henry was able to get a message to her and say, don't do it.
Well, he's able to get a message to her that has been approved by the barons.
Oh, so maybe she just bottled it. I don't think she did.
It's too far to say that she bottled it, because there are a lot of things that don't quite go her way. But equally, when giving her the credit for raising this big army, the negative is the fact that she wasn't actually able to get it to go to England. So ultimately, all that she did was raise a lot of debt.
Mm. Oh, it could have been amazing if she weren't stymied by weather and Pope action and Henry being an idiot.
So what are you thinking for a score for battliness?
Really good. She's taken Henry to court. Yeah. She stands up to him all the time to the point where he has to send her away to Guildford for 2 weeks. She's always prepared to take charge in the crisis and to get things back to normal if necessary, however, you know, patch things up. Mm. A pragmatic woman. And then D-Day chariots of fire across the... across the waters. Yeah, okay, didn't get to the water, but who else at this time, apart from Eleanor, would have pulled together a naval assault on Britain? It's brilliant. I can't remember if we do it out of 10 or 5, or 10. 20. 10, right.
We both do it out of 10, so it ends up being out of 20.
I think if that invasion had happened, whatever the outcome, I would have given a big 10, but I'm taking it down to an 8. Because it's meant to be about asserting her, well, being assertive is as a consort, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, I was thinking 8 as well. Like you said, if she had actually launched that invasion and come to England with it, then yeah, I think we're definitely talking a 10. That would have been amazing. But she does have to be marked down for the fact that she never actually manages to get it to England.
No.
But we're looking for, you know, independence of action, standing up for herself, all of that sort of thing. And the fact that she's raising an army, taking that level of intervention in military affairs, is also very, very impressive. Anyway, that is very impressive, because that is 16 out of 20 for battliness.
Scandal!
Well, unfortunately...
No.
I don't really think I've got anything to go on here. She's a controversial figure. She's occasionally at odds with Henry, and indeed with Edward. But I'm not sure that her behaviour is ever really scandalous. As I said, we've talked about...
enough to go to Guildford.
Yeah, but again, that's a dispute, rather than that it's not that, you know, she was suspected of having an affair with a noble or anything like that. She's at odds with Henry. So I fear there might need to be a zero for scandal.
Oh, actually nothing.
Well, I don't have any examples of...
No.
Juicy bits or affairs or corruption or...
Oh. Well, I mean, she was jolly busy, I suppose.
Mm.
Subjectivity.
So, after a century of dysfunctional Plantagenet rule, one of Eleanor's great achievements is to create a strong nuclear family unit of her husband and children. This is in stark contrast to what we've had before. Obviously, Henry II imprisoning Eleanor of Aquitaine, Richard the Lionheart neglecting Berengaria, Isabella of Angoulême's rather dubious loyalty to Henry as mother. Although, as we said, Eleanor sometimes acts against Henry on individual issues, they were a strong partnership. They did have a close relationship with each other. And indeed, she has a very close relationship with all of her children. She nursed Edward for 3 weeks when he fell ill at an all-male monastery, much to the annoyance of the monks who didn't really want to be there. Fought for her son Edmund to become king of Sicily, as we said. Her daughter Margaret, who became the Queen of Scots, returned from Scotland to Windsor so that Eleanor could be present at the birth of her first child. And when Edward gets married to Eleanor of Castile, Eleanor of Provence ensures that her daughter-in-law is welcomed into the family and works with her to persuade Edward to delay the marriage of his eldest daughter on account of her being too young, something of which both Eleanors had personal experience. Obviously, Eleanor of Provence only 12 when she was married to Henry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, my goodness. This is the same person who was 12
yeah.
when she came over. Mm. What a woman.
As a child of Provence, she's a highly cultured and well-read woman. She purchased numerous romances on figures such as Charlemagne, Alexander the Great, and William the Conqueror, and had a particular interest in King Arthur.
Mm.
There are over 20 manuscripts associated with Eleanor of Provence, either that she owned or that she commissioned, including an embellished history of Edward the Confessor, which was dedicated to her by Matthew Paris.
Hence the son's name?
Well, yes, because Henry III had something of an Edward the Confessor obsession, so that's something that Eleanor is sort of brought into by Henry early on and that she continues. So Edward I is named after Edward the Confessor. She introduced various luxuries to England, not only French fashions, but also glazed windows, tiled floors, curtains, and even table forks.
Really?
I think that glazed might be table windows? Forks as in a sort of a carving thing rather than cutlery.
Yeah. Okay. Well, but still, I mean, imagine life without a glazed window. Mm-hmm. Grim.
She designed gardens and also introduced the rose to English royal insignia. So Edward adopted the golden rose of Provence in his royal arms, while Edmund, as the Earl of Lancaster, adopted a red rose.
Huh. And then, oh, that's amazing. Wow, that's where that comes from.
Now, she's probably the most powerful queen consort since Matilda of Boulogne, Stephen's wife. Now, that might seem surprising, given some of the people that we've done in our previous run, but both Eleanor of Aquitaine and Isabella of Angoulême were notable, really, for their time as queen mother, whereas Eleanor of Provence is powerful and influential as queen consort.
Yeah. So she's going to get mega points for this.
So she owned extensive lands and wardships that she could do with as she pleased, standardised the use of Queen's Gold, which was a 10% levy on voluntary fines of 10 marks or more by the king. And in 1253, when Henry went to Gascony, she acted as regent for him. So she sat in judgment in the king's court, heard pleas in council and the exchequer. She issues letters patent, controls royal finances, receives embassy, even called a parliament, though that didn't actually end up meeting. And she was so dedicated, she only stopped work for a matter of days after giving birth to her fifth child, with Matthew Paris noting that she rose well from her childbed.
Yeah, she's a force of nature.
Most notably, of course, as we said, took on the leadership role of the royal cause from 1264 to 65 after Evesham. And actually, this is all quite reminiscent, really, of Matilda of Boulogne, because after Stephen was captured in the Battle of Lincoln, 1141, it was Matilda of Boulogne who then took control of his royal forces. Mm. Although, obviously, Matilda of Boulogne did actually succeed with her campaign.
Still, it's jolly good.
It's jolly good, but there are some negatives. Like Henry, Eleanor's financial affairs were not terribly well managed. When Henry died, she had debts of around £20,000, which in today's money is about £14.5 million.
Eesh.
And this is despite the fact that she'd taken £15,000 from a levy on clerical incomes after the Barons' War.
Mm. Wow, that is bad.
Now, in her defence, some of these debts are because of all the effort she had to go to in raising that mercenary force and doing stuff for the good of the royal cause. But given that it never set sail, she doesn't really have an awful lot to show for these huge debts.
Yeah, yeah.
She also has a slightly questionable attitude towards England's Jewish community.
Oh, that's where he gets it from.
So her father had respected and employed Jews in Provence, but her attitude seems to have been rather less amicable. In Henry's reign, she took a lot of money from taxes aimed at the Jewish community. And then in 1275, presumably the point at which she'd taken all the money they'd got to give her, she asked Edward that all Jews on her land be expelled.
And he did.
Well, indeed. Right? Now, there's no evidence for this, but there is a strong perception that she was an influence behind the decision to ultimately expel the Jews from England altogether.
Yeah, it wasn't Edward, it was his mum.
Now, she actually died a year before this happened. Even so, the fact that there's this perception about Eleanor of Provence does suggest that she's at the very least not seen as being a friend of the community.
Yeah, well, she's certainly not, yeah.
Now, you've been very impressed by Eleanor's leadership role in the Second Barons' War.
Yeah.
But there is a downside to that. And indeed, the Chronicle of Melrose felt that she had more than a little bit of responsibility for what went wrong. Eleanor of Provence, Queen of England, was believed to be the root, the fermenter and disseminator of all the discord which was sown between her husband, King Henry, and the barons of his kingdom.
Yeah, but if something goes wrong, what do? You blame the lady.
Well, it's obviously a gross exaggeration, but Eleanor's actions really were a factor in the discontent among the barons. I mentioned how Henry had to take this oath to uphold the provisions of Oxford. Eleanor is also forced to take an oath to uphold the provisions, which you wouldn't necessarily expect a queen to do unless they obviously saw her as being a prime antagonist in the disputes.
Yeah. And that powerful.
Powerful, but also unpopular. The black hole that is Henry's royal finances is partly Eleanor's, well, not her fault, but she contributes to it. So her very expensive tastes and fashions and whatnot. The disastrous Sicilian business that you mentioned with her son Edmund taking on that huge papal debt and spending loads of money getting absolutely nowhere.
Yeah, that was...
After the provisions of Oxford, we also have the provisions of Westminster, which had clauses such as a committee which would rule on the sale of wardships in the King's Gift and in what areas the Queen's Gold tariff would apply. So in other words, these were reforms measures aimed directly at Eleanor. So it's not just the king is mismanaging his kingdom, it's the queen is mismanaging as well. There was huge discontent at the ubiquity of foreigners at court, because there are over 170 Savoyards in England, thanks to Eleanor's Eleanor's influence. And she arranges lots of illustrious marriages for her Savoyard kinsmen, and it's usually male Savoyards marrying illustrious English heiresses. So that's frustrating all the ambitions of English noble families, because you're seeing lands and titles being given away to these foreigners.
Coming over here, taking our free money.
Indeed. When Richard marries her sister, which again, obviously, is something that she has a bit of a helping hand in, Matthew Paris recorded, "The whole community in England, taking it ill, began to fear that the whole business of the kingdom would be disposed of at the will of the queen and her sister." Now, whilst it was nothing new for an English queen to be foreign, Eleanor seems to have made very little effort to establish herself as an English figure. She has no real personal contact with English noble families. She imports all of her books and her clothes. There's a sense that she always looks down on provincial England and sees her real hinterland as being these European networks that she has. And this is all exacerbated by her leadership in the war when she raises a huge European mercenary army, and thus, for the perspective of the common folk who are forced to come out to muster all along the coast ready to face off the invasion, we've got a foreign queen raising a foreign army getting ready to come over and murder and plunder good old common Englishmen.
Eleanor
was particularly unpopular in London. During her regency in 1253, she rigidly enforced a tax due to her on boats unloading at Queenhithe, and two sheriffs were arrested for failing to cooperate with her demands. In 1257, England suffered a terrible harvest leading to famine, but she still demanded that the citizens pay her the backlog of Queen's gold. Now, the full extent of what Londoners thought of her was shown in 1263. As we mentioned, this was when Henry and Eleanor are holed up in the Tower of London. Eleanor decides to leave Henry behind and seek out Edward. But the annals of Dunstable describe what actually happened. The Queen left the Tower by the Thames on her way to Windsor by boat and came to London Bridge. When the Londoners assailed her and her men shamefully with foul and base words and even casting stones, so that, freed with difficulty by the Mayor of London and driven by necessity, she went back to the Tower. So apparently the mob were shouting, "Down with the witch, let's drown her." So if the Mayor of London hadn't come along, who was actually quite a radical reformer, but he obviously had his limits, then the situation really could have been very serious indeed.
So, yeah, so we could view this as Henry saying to Eleanor, "Eleanor, love, they hate you. You know, don't go out there." She goes, "I will do what I like," and storms off, and sure enough gets pelted with all sorts of things and has to come back, but isn't let in, and she hides with the bishop. Yeah, it's not quite so grand, is it?
She's also seems to have something of a vindictive streak. So after the war, she persuades Henry in 1270 to grant her custody of London Bridge, but she refuses to pay for its upkeep. So when Edward becomes king, the citizens petition him for relief, complaining that she taketh all the tolls and careth not how the bridge is kept. And indeed, she ultimately resigns in 1281 when some of the arches do actually collapse.
It gets that bad. Are they repaired?
Well, ultimately, yes. But they are, along with Matilda of Scotland, Eleanor of Provence is another candidate for being the My Fair Lady in the nursery rhyme London Bridge is Falling Down.
Huh. Yeah. Oh, Rex fact. I'll have that.
Now, it's notable that overall, Eleanor's legacy in queenship is not positive. No foreign queen afterwards is allowed to retain her countrymen at court after Eleanor of Provence and the reaction to the Savoyards. Edward, although he admires his mother, isn't willing to give anything like that sort of power to his queen, even though, as we'll see, he does love her very much, let alone give any power to his mother. So he is obviously very clearly aware of just how unpopular she is and the extent to which that led to partly the rebellion and a lot of the discontent.
Yeah.
But many historians believe Eleanor of Provence may well be the most unpopular queen in English history.
Oh, you've taken it all away.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? There's lots of stuff that shows she's very impressive, very competent. So as I said at the start, her focus is always that family unit and those strengths. And she's very much got tunnel vision about that. So she really just doesn't care about the other stuff. She's not really interested in being Queen of England in the sense of the good of the English people, any of that. It really is the family and nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't really like them by the sounds of things. Oh dear. Oh, it was looking so rosy, G-Man.
Yeah, so in terms of her competence and, like, would you trust her ability to administer a nation's affairs, you'd say, well, yes, she's probably pretty competent, she could do it
100%.
But would you want her as your queen?
Well, the first half of this I would have said definitely
when
yes.
I was doing the good bits.
When you're doing the good bits. I feel like it's for me a five, because she just is so supremely competent at getting on when it seems like Henry isn't. Five from me.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think I'm inclined to mark her down more than I am to mark her up. It's one of those where her positives are her negatives. You know, the reason that she succeeds in many ways is because she is so committed to just protecting the family interest. She doesn't really care about the subjectivity bit, I don't think. This wouldn't have been what she was after.
Mm.
But I think that tells in just how incredibly unpopular she is. So I'm going to mark her down for a four for subjectivity. I think she'd be able to manage the government effectively, but I don't think you'd feel enamoured of her if she was your queen.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's like having an incredibly competent government in power whose politics you don't agree with. You know, they'll deal with a crisis.
So, four from me, a five from you. That's nine for subjectivity.
Longevity.
So, Eleanor was Queen Consort of England from the 14th of January 1236 to the 16th of November 1272, which is 36.83 years.
That's good.
She was then Queen Mother until her death on the 24th of June 1291, which was another 18.58 years. So that would make for 55.41 years of queenship, which is very impressive, though her time as Queen Mother only gets half marks. So take 9.29 off the top, 46.12 years of queenship that actually counts to her score. And it's a very impressive score of 17.5 out of 20.
Oof. Is that the biggest pre-modern
times? So
it's
the best one that we've had thus far, and it's the third best overall.
Dynasty, not the program.
So Eleanor has four children who survive Henry III. They also had a fifth child in 1253, a daughter called Catherine. She seems to have had some form of disability, and both Henry and Eleanor are stricken with grief when sadly she died just 4 years old. But that means the score that Eleanor gets credit for is four children who survive Henry III. So that gives her a dynasty score of 14 out of 20, which is the joint 16th best overall. And overall, that gives her a grand total of 56.5.
Where's that?
Is joint 6th so far.
That is very good.
But it's not all about the score. Does she have that certain something, that great achievement, the star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
I feel like my bubble's been burst.
You were all set until I told you how much everybody hated
and
her.
And for what quite sound reasons. I'm disappointed, G-Man. I mean, but imagine if she'd boudicca'd the life off those off that invasion.
Because I think it was interesting when you were doing your examples of the films and you were saying D-Day, D-Day, Chariots of Fire. I think ultimately the problem was that it was just Chariots of Fire. She was just running along the beach rather than actually...
And maybe she was just as rubbish as that film.
I mean, in her favour, you know, she's a very strong, very influential queen consort. She's probably the most powerful that we've seen in about 100 years in terms of actually when she was queen consort as opposed to being queen mother. She does show incredible leadership during the Second Barons' War. And, you know, it is disappointing that she doesn't get that army over, because you feel like that is the thing that would have switched it. If she had got the army over... That's a Rex Factor moment. The downside is that she doesn't get the army over. It's Edward that gets the royal victory rather than Eleanor. And she's incredibly unpopular and partly responsible for the Barons' War happening in the first place. And it does give a bit of a knock to queens. The fact that we've got all these foreign queens to come and they're now not going to have their relatives coming with them. Edward thinks, well, if I've learned one thing for my mother, it's not to let that happen again.
Yeah, it's so nearly, isn't it? It could have been something you definitely want to repeat. Look at this safety we had here when Henry was locked up. We had this excellent queen, blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, she sets it up for Edward to refine those skills into one tall, sexy package.
The fact that she's so unpopular and that she's a factor in the Barons' War and all this sort of stuff... She could still have got the Rex Factor if she'd beaten the Barons. Like, she so nearly did. Well, we don't know what would have happened if she got the army over, of course. That's not a guarantee that she'd have won, but it would have been amazing if she had.
Oh, yeah. What a moment.
And it's interesting, having made that comparison with Matilda of Boulogne, of course, Matilda of Boulogne, as you said, when Stephen was captured, she takes control of that army. She doesn't have to bring it over, and it is already there, but she is able to stop the Empress Matilda being crowned, and she is ultimately actually able to get her husband out and restore the status quo. So we have seen this role done by a consort before, and it have been done successfully.
Oh, I think I agree.
So it's a no from
me. Yeah, no.
And it's a no from Ali.
I really wanted to, though.
I know. I'm sorry.
Correspondence Corner.
So that was the life and consortship of Eleanor of Provence, and she did not have the Rex Factor. Let us know what you thought about her and if you agreed with our decision. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram, where we are at Rex Factor Pod. Like the Rex Factor Podcast Facebook page or email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com. And remember to send in your episode image, your hashtag consort cards. We haven't had any of these for a while, and obviously we've not actually been podcasting for a while, but we're back in place now, so get us an episode image for Eleanor and any of the other queen consorts if you fancy it.
Yeah.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can leave a review and subscribe on whatever podcast provider you use. Alternatively, you can support us financially, donate monthly, join the Privy Council, and get lots and lots of bonus content. And to do that, remember, you now go to patreon.com/RexFactor. And if you are a patron on Podbean at the moment, and it's June, remember that in July it will only be on Patreon, so you'll need to switch over. And we've got some new Privy Councillors to welcome to the fold. Catherine Cully, Marcello Armando, Suzanne Stockton, John KB, A. Arscott, Andy Orball, IKA Plan 1721, Process G, Chelsea Cook, MJN Egrin, Emilu 83, Batgirl Ali, Shanna 1003, Chris Double, Joey Harlandross, Hazelnut Cereal, Lady of America, and someone whose name was in the script for the Eldgith of Mercia episode, but for some reason I didn't read her out, even though it was in my notes. A big thank you and welcome, belatedly, to Catherine Coffey.
Hey! Do we really have a Privy Councillor called Smelly Cheese?
Processed cheese.
Processed cheese. That's great. Oh, put him in charge of catering.
And now some messages from Privy Councillors. First up, Rachel Cullum. It's been fantastic to listen over the past year or so and has kept me entertained on many a walk and bike commute. I even listened to the Edward the Elder episode in early labour as a distraction. Ooh. Unfortunately, it didn't help much.
I can imagine. I mean, even my wife found my voice annoying, so I don't know what it'd be like for someone else. Poor, no dear.
Next up, Guy Lawful. I know I'm very late to join the rest of the council. My cousin has been telling me about you for years now, but I only just got into the podcast in the last 3 months or so. Keep up the fantastic work.
Cheers.
Doug, Lulu and Lexi say, hello. I was recommended your podcast a year ago and have now caught up, so decided to join the Privy Council to get more episodes. I'm looking forward to Isabella, the She-Wolf of France.
Ah, well, welcome.
Not too far away from her now, the next miniseries. Mm. A few other quickies from Privy Councillors. David Thompson says, keep it going, guys, from a loyal listener in Hadley, Essex.
Hey, good castle. Well, I mean, not much left, but haunting.
Dramatic.
That's the word.
Punk Rock Mum says, long-time listener and finally a PC member. Love you guys. Stay safe.
Cheers, dude.
And finally, Laura McKenzie. This podcast has become one of my absolute faves. You guys are brilliant. I can't wait to listen to the special episodes.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that is the good thing, isn't it? All that other content.
Privy Chambers, Rex Flicks where we watch films, special episodes, the feature-length stuff, pub quizzes, is all sorts in the Privy Council.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, another consort limerick from Louise Brimacombe.
Oh, super duper.
This time for Adeliza of Louvain.
Which one was she?
Adeliza, King Henry's young bride, spent 15 fruitless years by his side. Though he stopped his affairs, she gave him no heirs, but had 7 kids after he died.
Oh, very good.
So that's all from us and Eleanor of Provence, who didn't quite manage to do enough to get herself the Rex Factor. We'll be back next time with the first consort of Edward I. And confusingly for Ali, it's another Eleanor. This time, Eleanor of Castile.
Dun, dun, dun. Lovely.
See you next time.
Cheerio.